I hope the conversation that will follow will be at least as delightful and substantial as this buffet was. So, you know the drill for the ones of you that were with us this morning. I'm just going to run over the run through the slides once again to tell us a little bit about blockchain for good, and then we'll start with the third unconference of the day. So, hi, my name is Pierre Noreau. I am a lecturer and researcher at Sciences Po University at the Tech and Global Affairs Lab Hub of Sciences Po. I'm also the digitization expert of the Word Sufficiency Lab that has just been launched by IPCC member Yamina Saheb. And it's been 8 years that I've been trying to build cool stuff with blockchain that has a positive impact on people and society. Which makes me just a bit older than Blockchain for Good itself, which is a nonprofit NGO that was co-founded in 2018, and which is a collective of academics and practitioners. All of you are invited. If you're interested in collaborating with us, please do. We are a jolly bunch of people that have three main missions. The first one is that we do collect data on impact-oriented projects built with public blockchain globally, and we release this data as an open data set. We also write sectorial reports designed to give an overview of what's currently going on, what's being developed, but also putting the spotlights on projects that are having a positive impact today. We try really hard to adopt a truly global lens that is not just focusing on Global North projects, but also projects that are impacting and are being built by Global South communities. And finally, and you might have noticed, we are organizing events that go really range from small community meetups to massive open events like this one. This morning, you have had the opportunity to hear about digital identity and privacy, then how blockchain is transforming the supply chain, especially for food, water, energy, and other primary commodities. And so before we jump into peer-to-peer money for good, it's time to talk about climate and the environment. Just before that, I am contractually obliged to give a quick word of thanks to our sponsors that enable us to independently organize our activities and publish every bit of research and open source and Creative Commons licenses. So Institut Louis Bachelier, Blockchain and Polytechnique, Groupe Caisse des Dépôts, BPI France, and Crédit Agricole Corporate Investment Bank. We love them. One thanks. I'm not going to make you clap for them, but still. Just a few rules about the conversation. This conversation is recorded. Only the audio, if you see some cameras around, it's to take pictures, but the event, there are no videos, so we can really focus on content of the discussion and not on the looks, although you all look very, very beautiful. If you do not want to be recorded, then you won't be able to talk into the mic. I'm sorry about that. But this will be released as a podcast on our channels. After a quick intro, that will help us set the stage, we will have an open conversation in which all of you are guests. We do have some special guests that have, you know, a long, an extensive expertise of the topic, but we really want this this discussion to be reflective of our values, that is very open, decentralized, transparent. So if you have any questions, if you want to contribute your own ideas, talk about your own projects, please raise your hands, a mic will come to you, and there are no hierarchy between our guests. And so the discussion is really collectively driven. We value diverse perspectives. Please just remain respectful of each other's point of views. Just if you are willing to speak, you will wait for a microphone to come to you. It helps us record it. Everyone really wants to hear you. You're invited to give your name and your organization, if you do have one. But if you want to stay anonymous, we take that as well. Okay? So enjoy the conference, and I'm going to make a very, very quick introduction. The first thing that comes to mind when we talk about blockchain and climate might be the negative impact of blockchain technologies on the environment. And while Bitcoin's impact, both in terms of carbon, in terms of water consumption, are concerning, especially if you look beyond the direct emissions of mining. The scope 2 and scope 3 impacts, that is the indirect impacts that are generated by the manufacturing, for instance, of the mining hardware, any non-proof-of-work blockchain have environmental impacts that are somewhat similar to any digital systems, okay? So while it is very important to acknowledge that those negative impacts exist, this will really not be the focus of our discussion today. We are really going to try to focus on how blockchain tech can have positive impacts on climate and ecosystems. Everybody's good with that? Fine. So let's talk about what blockchain can do to bring a transformative change to the way we protect, the way we also regenerate ecosystems worldwide. Well, the first thing is that I want to mention is that green finance really needs a kick in the butt. Why that? Well, the first thing is that we have a huge gap in terms of how much money is going to protect climate, protect the environment. Anyone wants to take a guess at how much more money we need annually to actually meet the estimates to reach sustainability?
10 trillion.
Annually?
I think that's globally. Annually, yeah. Okay. I've seen that number.
Well, the latest World Economic Forum figures were 2.3, and I think 10 billion is for the SDGs globally.
Trillions.
Trillions. Yeah.
So.
In any way, many trillions is the answer per year. Once again, like this is not until 2050. Like this is per year. So there is a huge need to funnel more money into those projects.
Does anybody know how many dollars in dollar terms were climate finance was in 2023 against that figure of 5 or 2 trillion?
Please tell me this is a rhetoric question because I did not prepare this number.
We all should hear.
Ah, nice.
1.8.
I hear between 1.3 and 1.8.
Yeah, exactly.
Billion, not trillion.
Trillion. So, you know, we should also give ourselves a little applause here because, frankly, none of that money would be floating around if it weren't for cohorts like these meeting around the world.
Hmm.
A lot of work.
Now, one more thing that I want to add regarding the kick in the butt that we need to give to green finance in general is that markets that deal with asset based on nature are heavily trust based, heavily centralized, somewhat decorrelated from the underground reality, right? Last year, the CEO of Verra, the leading company that is operating the Verra carbon credit standard, and the certifier of those voluntary carbon credits has had to quit because The Guardian has revealed that more than 90% of all of those credits were virtually worthless. It was impossible to prove that they actually have a positive impact on the environment. So those markets are very dysfunctional. And blockchain does provide some interesting answers to that, whether it is enhancing transparency, bringing more auditability, integrating with existing financial markets or decentralized financial markets to scale them up and increase liquidity, make greener investments more verifiable or pulling them together to limit the risks of the investors. All of that is stuff that we will have the opportunity to talk about during the conversation. Second thing I want to bring on green finance is that there can be no sustainable transition without a fair transition, right? Because let's face it, the reality is that those money flows are not symmetric, right? Like most of the economic growth that was created through the historic emissions of carbon went to the global north countries and their economies, and most of the investments that are needed to achieve sustainability are located in global south countries that are also the most impacted ones by those climate transitions. This acceleration of funding cannot possibly work without dramatically changing the governance of how we fund the sustainable transitions and make sure that they do not spun into neo-colonial relationships between very wealthy countries that have really enjoyed that have really contributed to the current situation, towards countries that are yet to achieve mass development and are very threatened by the current climate situation. So we need to think about how blockchain can mean more bottom-up governance, how it can empower IPLC, that is indigenous people and local communities, to strengthen forms of local stewardship of those ecosystems and really create opportunities for the people on the ground that will be in charge of changing and protecting and preserving nature. And this can be done through decentralized MRV, for instance. And just because I want all of us to agree on base definition, MRV stands for monitoring, reporting, sometimes valuation or verification, depends on what hides behind this V. And so blockchain technology can be a way to harness the knowledge, the experience of local communities who inhabit those ecosystems to make them active in the assessment of the health of an ecosystem and thus of the value of the financial asset that would be based on those natural ecosystems. And that can be very well paired with very high-tech tools. Think about satellite imagery, AI-enabled dynamic cartography of those ecosystems. There are plenty of super projects like the Open Forest Protocols or Gain Forest are experimenting with those alternative ways to just assess how well those ecosystems are doing. One other example is Collectivo, a Curaçao-based DAO framework where local communities can decide to map their own ecosystems, issue their own tokens to finance both ecosystem-based adaptation, but also local and sovereign stablecoins. And finally, the third thing that I really want to mention is that blockchain tech can help us move beyond, also think about alternative models that do not commodify nature, that do not marketize nature too much, right? And that can change the relationship we have with nature in the way we try to preserve it. All of that can be part of the conversation. And in order to set up this conversation, to initiate it, I will have the pleasure to invite all of our guests. So Luis Boreani from Eco Frontiers, who's just over there, Jeanne Bloch, who's an artist, activist, and sustainability expert, but particularly active on COSIOL, right?
Yes, I founded COSIOL.
Andrea Leiter, who's assistant professor at the Amsterdam Center for International Law and who co-founded the Sovereign Nature Initiative. Ramzi Layeb, over there, from Carbonable. I believe we have Marcus Aurelius from Klima DAO. Sorry, Stephen Haft from the Ethereum Climate Platform, and Vincent. Did Vincent arrive? Yeah, Vincent from Vincent Kachavenda from Arable. So let's get into the thick of the meat, and let's start really with a very pragmatic, down-to-earth, grass-touching question of when it comes to sustainability. What are you doing with blockchain that you couldn't do otherwise?
Sure. Hi, everybody. Great to be here with you today. So at KlimaDAO, one of the unique advantages of blockchain that we're leveraging is transparency. In particular, transparency around the flow of money through the carbon credit market. So we're really focused on carbon credits right now. That's how I'll couch my discussion. But in theory, a lot of these market mechanisms could apply to other markets as well, which I think we'll get a chance to speak about. In particular, when a traditional corporation goes and buys carbon credits on the existing carbon credit market, they're typically placing that order through a broker who settles that transaction over the phone. They send an email, a wire transfer gets sent, and a PDF gets delivered. And we think that process ends up leading to a lot of opacity, both in terms of the way the claim is being made. Usually you have to go into a 50-page PDF on the company's website to figure out what credits they actually used, and also in the way the money is flowing down to the project developer. And we think that blockchain technology can do a lot to increase the transparency and reduce the friction to find out what a company is actually doing when they claim that they're carbon neutral, as well as where the money is going when they purchase a carbon credit on the market.
I also have a theory that the Paris Agreement, which was made in 2015 and signed in early 2016. Interestingly, at the exact same time that Ethereum was launching, I think especially in here we are in this sort of very French environment, I think we need to acknowledge that there are times in the world where there are ideas that are traveling just as ideas that are showing up all over the world because of the way ideas travel. The French Revolution and the American Revolution, Locke, Rousseau, all that stuff that we've studied in school, I think we can acknowledge there was a period of time in which there were a handful of ideas that were transforming the world. I think in 2015 and 2016, there was a genuine commonality between the intentions of the creation of Ethereum and the Paris Agreement itself, because in when you look at the Paris Agreement, actually just sit down and read the thing, the word transparency, I don't know how many times it shows up, but maybe four or five shows up, and you listen to Vitalik or Joe or anybody around the launch of Ethereum, there we are. In the Paris Agreement, so-called Article 6, is all about the end of financial duplicity. We're going to put an end to, you know, fraudulent greenwashing and financial duplicity. Well, if you listen to what's coming out of the Ethereum team then, and thank goodness still today, it's the same sort of mission-driven wording that comes, I think, from both. The Article 10 of the Paris Agreement spread spread technology globally in order, new technology in particular, globally in order to solve the climate problem. Move, the Paris Agreement again, is take decision-making out of central bodies and spread it around. I mean, these were the, this is in the agreement, these are the intentions of those 195 signers. And I think if you match it up against the foundations of Ethereum that for which we gather at the moment, I think you'll find tremendous commonality. So I have a slightly different view, which is if instead of building rooms full of public policy people to implement the Paris Accords, if they hired engineers, they would have built Ethereum.
Very nice. I think that's very nice. I'm going to take your beautiful ramp and say, indeed, I think for a Sovereign Nature Initiative, one of the main reasons why we are in the crypto space is the crypto community and the things that are possible within that space rather than the nitty-gritty of the technology in and of itself yet. So I think building on the question, the Paris Agreement binds states, no, international lawyer by background. So really politics are thought through states and institutions. And I think there is no comparable community to the blockchain community that shows an alternative to how you do things collectively, also backed with sufficient funding and a lot of ability, a lot of energy, a lot of skill, a lot of drive and desire. So I think that in the same way in which we are seeing that politics through the state apparatuses are not holding their promise anymore and people are looking for alternatives, how else and with whom else can we secure the future beyond the state? I think that's where the crypto community comes in, and I think that we can speak more about the detail of how and what, but I think for Sovereign Nature Initiative, that's the core of why blockchain and how in blockchain, and then the transparency plays a giant role, not to underplay, to downplay that, but I do think that's the zeitgeist argument, I think, is the strongest.
I mean, next to and not beyond of transparency, if we go very simple, if we have a climate crisis today, it's because there's some cost extra, you know, externalities that are not accounted into the balance sheet of any companies. So we have a lack of accounting externalities that are negative and also that are positive. And that's another area that blockchain can really bring into the climate crisis, which is to, you know, incorporate into the financial accounting the extra, what we call today extra financial assets, which is a word I hope we won't use anymore in the next years.
And this now should pass to Carbonable, I think, because you guys are doing great work.
I can try. So, yeah, so already the information you had, you provided is pretty complete and really, really detailed. I will just provide a conviction, a personal conviction about, I started at corporate during 10 years. I worked to find solutions to operate a strategy. And if if you look at the theory of how to reduce, how what to put in place, the carbon credit itself is a theory that is pretty good, how we could operate it correctly. I think the subject of trust is how do I started with this one. So how do I know that someone is doing right without patching him? How do I trust someone? At the end, I'm starting to change the view, and now I'm going how as an individual, because this one I'm considering that people don't try to act correctly. So now I'm checking the other one. How as an actor, as in a company that want to do to execute my theory, how do I prove that I'm doing the right thing without anyone watching? And this is one I think cryptography, and more specifically maybe applicated on the blockchain, could be interesting, because it could help me to generate proofs that the data is not obsolete, proves that I'm doing some computation on the right formula, prove that I'm doing some planification on how I will provide an execution for my commitment. So I say I will be carbon neutral, for example. How do I do it? So do I rely on commitment, or do we rely on proof? So as an engineer worked on operational execution, I rely on proof of execution and on planifications. This is my approach.
So if I had to put a word on that, not just transparency, but verifiability.
Yeah, I'm starting to move on the transparency. I worked for Procter & Gamble, and this is the first company that we starting talk to with when we start in Carbonable, and don't talk about transparency to P&G because they don't want to dox any information. And this is how big company thinks, because if they miss something, because anyone can do things wrong, and this happened, but companies are relying on the reputation, and they will not take any risk on the reputation because they know that we can lose it like really fast. So I'm starting moving on the more on the verifiability, but I'm also maybe influenced by all the things on the ZKP and so on. But I'm really interested about what it can provide as a feature. And
But this, it seems to me, is also part of the alignment between the technology and the needs of the growing community to address our climate crisis. ZK comes along. Suddenly, you have this now compliance and institutional need for corporations to account to the public in ways, to your point, they haven't before. These were considered externalities. Now they're internalized to a greater degree through compliance requirements. But what ZK now allows the corporations to do is, yes, there's certain data they are not prepared to share and maybe shouldn't have to. I mean, this is a values discussion. You come out one side or the other, but they nevertheless need to present accurate information insofar as compliance requires it. And the ZK coming along at this point does allow them to keep certain information off-chain, but enough information to proof of compliance crosses over to the next block and then becomes the basis in which our technology helps them solve their problems. So,
okay, two very quick things there. For the ones of you that hear ZK and are wondering what's going on there, so we are referring to zero knowledge family of cryptography, which is kind of cryptographic treatment that allows you to prove that you hold some information without disclosing that information, or even sometimes to compute on top of an information without disclosing this information. Let's just try to refocus really on the more pragmatic first round of question. We still have at least two guests that haven't been able to talk. Yeah. So please, when it comes to Erable, what is the new thing that blockchains allows you to do in terms of sustainable finance or sustainability in general that was really impossible without it?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually, because we've been working a lot on Web2 solutions the past few months because we feel it's really hard to get people on board. But there are solutions with counter abstractions, etc., that will definitely onboard more people directly. But the main thing, technically speaking, was about transparency, efficiency. I'm doing revenue sharing assets. So basically, people invest in a project or an asset, and they get a share of the revenues that are generated, or the value generated, whether it's a positive impact or just revenues. And the efficiency we have with the technology is quite amazing, because you just with smart contracts, everything is easier. I have a lot less time to put on the administrative side of thing. And it's just working. But to jump back on what you said before, I think what I've been seeing is empowerment. Like, you have 100 people around the project. They financed specific assets, let's say, for instance, electric vehicles. And now they feel empowered. I'm not saying it's not feasible without Web3, without blockchain, but now they feel, I can govern, I can say how we use the money, I have a better traceability on how the funds are getting used, and it's really empowering them to be more than an investor, but contribute to the projects and the success of it.
Louise, last but not least, and especially like a lot of things were thrown out in this way, but I know that you're working also on the word commons and how the COP21 was a moment in which there was a common push for the protection of nature. When it comes to commoning, to create commons around blockchain-based green finance. I know that you've been working on some interesting stuff, so can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, so I'm the co-author of a book called The Green Crypto Handbook, but I'm also the co-founder of a project called the Region Atlas. And Region Atlas started with this exact climate finance gap that you just mentioned, and we were thinking, how do we fix this? How do we redirect more liquidity towards the climate crisis? And green crypto was the solution, so blockchain were the solution for us for the reason that have been just summed up here. But if I sum it up, it's three main reasons, right? The first one is trust minimized, so it doesn't need an institution to verify. The second is that 24/7 global markets open nonstop, so super accessible. And the third one is that it's open source, democratic, and just climate transition won't happen if community is not on board, if the application is not designed and made for whoever is using, co-owned by whoever is using it. I guess that summed up a little bit why green assets should be on chain, have to be on chain.
All right, and at this point, I want to let you know that the first introductory round is over, so if you want to contribute, please just raise your hands and someone will come to you and hand you a mic and you will be able to enlighten us with beautiful questions or fascinating use cases.
Thanks so much. I'm pretty excited to hear more from you. There were words around they're like assets, externalities, but actually you don't really want to use those words. And now you just mentioned, we actually just need these green assets. I'm wondering, where do you see opportunities to use the financial system through blockchain, and hopefully blockchain helping with transparency, trust, verifiability, whatever. So where do you see the opportunities in that? But also where do you see challenges or actually risks in putting green values and non-human nature value out there on the financial market, which might mean speculation and stuff, drawing in the wrong people, perhaps.
Yeah, I guess I can start with a challenge that we're working in, at least in the carbon markets, we're working in an incumbent industry. This market's been around for 30 years. There are powerful financial interests already at play. And so one of the tensions that I felt working in this the sort of intersection of climate action and blockchain technology is that some of the incumbents are not super excited about blockchain technology. Maybe they have some outdated notions about the environmental impact of blockchain, or that it's used by criminals and money launderers, or that they see it as a risk to their status quo business model. And that's sometimes can turn off people who you might otherwise want to work with. Getting incumbents on board in a way that they feel they don't feel so threatened necessarily, but threatening them just enough to push them to change the way they do things, but still come along for the ride has definitely been a challenge.
Yeah, maybe I can add. I think in our work, one of the biggest challenges is not the pure question of commodification or not, or assetization or not. I do think that there is just the answer, of course, you have to work with it and you have to try to push through in some way. I'm not a believer of against in that sense. But I think that the big question is, what's the distributional outcome of that and how do you organize that? And so for us, we see between green finance and green tech, there is really like almost a closure that goes into a perfect translation of data from all sorts of sensors, be it remote or close, that can then be fed into what all sorts of risk metrics that could give you an insight about how nature is doing. Now, so I mean, green finance constantly is asking, how is nature doing? And you have to have an answer for that in order to be able to value the product. And I think that here in this closure, from pushing on the one hand green finance and on the other hand green tech that provides answers to that, that can be remote, that can be easy, the question is who is benefiting from that and in which way, and how can you keep communities who work on the ground in the loop? So I think one of the things that for us at SNI is a core feature is speaking of human sensors or antennas in the mud. So really to try and push for saying it's impossible to have this kind of information in any credible way, say, quoting here Vera and the scandal, no, without bringing the communities who live on the ground into the loop, and then they have to have the biggest chunk of whatever is being done there. So I think squaring that somehow, that is something that we are pushing hard for, and I think it's a big challenge.
But if we want to reach this 6.5, I'm going to be provocative, it's a trillion, we also need to onboard the big investors. And that's what, you know, so COSIAL is a project that I started within the XRPL ecosystem and working with other partners there in order to help development banks attract private investors. But to make, you know, climate program from development banks attractive to private investors. And when you see private investors, and I'm talking about, you know, institutional and banks, they are complaining a lot about the lack of credible data. So I heard people from very big French banks saying, I'm in charge of the green fund, and I can tell you that 95% of the fund is not green. You know, and on the other hand, you have like a myriad of initiatives trying to produce new frameworks of new data that are going to be credible. Then they'd be going to be on a credible carbon market. So you know, to me, the question is that, and I found that people that are trying to make credible data for simple DEX, simple finance, not green finance, have similar issues. So the question about credible data, which to me is also very symptomatic of the time we are living in, you know, how can we have again a shared way of evaluating what we value, you know? And so for me that remains a big problem, and for COSIAL it's a very hard work in educating people with different culture. I mean, we have to take this into account. You know, you bring new things, you experiment new tools, new technologies, we people working in different ways. So it's a lot of work in terms of communicating and education and sharing a common language. And I'd love to get, you know, answers from all you all. It will help me.
I think you were saying it's about credible data. I do agree with that, but I think it's more than that, the reason why institutional buyers are not stepping in the green market now, and I've had similar conversation, I think, also with head of banks who are like, yeah, okay, I'm ready to invest in green, but can you give me something that's stable, liquid, low risk, and like, right? Green crypto can't offer that today. So that's why at Region Atlas, we talk about second order assets, so assets that would derive the value from the first order assets that we already have in green crypto, so those place-based assets like carbon offsets, physical, that are tied to the physical reality, right? How can we derive value from those first order assets and create maybe indexes, yield tokens, stable coins that will be maybe more interesting to those institutional buyers you were talking about, and maybe with the credible data on chain and second order assets that are much more interesting for the balance sheet, they will be able to enter the green crypto market.
A quick one on the same subject, if you have time enough. So putting in on the blockchain from carbon credit for itself, I think it's something non-tangible. So you don't have any project behind one carbon credit. It's like an estimation, a calculation of a potential absorption of an area. So based on this, I think the blockchain is only the system. it's a tool, And the question could be, what is the best ecosystem to manage those assets and those commodities, or if we can call it like this. So have green assets on the blockchain. It could be an answer to what is the best place to manage those kind of assets technically. There's the financial part, but there's also the operating part, because at the end it's accounting. You have to put it in front of emission measurements to get to a certain level of carbon neutrality, if you can still say this word. But yeah, I think it's more a research of having the best ecosystem to manipulate and to modelize those assets with their complexity of related to all the metadata. And I think blockchain could be an answer to provide like capability and features at a cheap price.
Gert-Jan Storm, DEP. We are behind an initiative, bc100plus.org. A few members are here, just for information. I would like to raise a question about the new phenomenon of energy demand in artificial intelligence, large language models, and data. Does your community feel the pressure? And so, what are you going to do about it? It's kind of an overwhelming issue when you look at the scope, and in our work focusing on the EU, we would plead for a precautionary approach to policy making to address this as a matter of urgency. It will not happen, but it's still there. Urgency is about risks in the planetary boundaries issues, and mitigation would be about opportunities for the common good and the public interest as a context to what we are discussing here. Just for information, when it is about biodiversity we are involved in, it's amongst others about the target of eliminating $500 billion dollars in subsidies for agriculture by 2030 globally, of which a fair share for the EU. And generally, IMF work over the past 10 years is about 6 to 7 trillion energy subsidies producers, consumers, with adverse impacts. Just about figures. The question is about, apart from the observation about energy demand, do you detect a tendency to a more integrated approach to pricing externalities? Because it's nice to talk about carbon pricing, water pricing is there as well, land pricing might come, land use. And the reason to mention is that biodiversity as a general theme covers a lot of opportunities to mitigate climate change at scale rapidly in food systems, food losses and waste, and stuff like that. I mention these because I finalize with that observation, as I suggested this morning. Could we find common ground between, on the one hand, the initiatives in the blockchain world and in the world I try to contribute to, the biodiversity world, both driven and informed by common interest and public good and the ODDs, the SDGs? Thank you.
If I may, you talk about the need for corporations to account for their externalities, so-called, because they shouldn't be considered externalities. And I think that's, Raymond, is that you? I think so, from BC 100. We have to account for our own. And our own are significant. I mean, proof of work at this point will annually now be responsible for emissions of over 100 million metric tons a year, I think, 94 million of which are just Bitcoin. But when you have the president of one country, Iceland in this case, Bjarni, who is otherwise, among world leaders, a pretty fair person when it comes to new tech, a friend of sorts to I think what we're trying to accomplish, who has to say, I have a choice between allowing Bitcoin miners in my country and running my schools. This is a choice he shouldn't have to make. And so we do, to your point, need to embrace this. And there's going to come a moment where we're going to be able to escape it. And that moment's coming fairly quickly. Because AI and its demands for energy and other resources will dwarf blockchain very quickly. We will look like a leaky faucet in Lyon compared to AI. And at that moment, there may be a feeling we can kind of, well, nobody's paying so much attention. They're all focused on cleaning up AI. We can't, to your point, ask corporates to incorporate their externalities without ourselves equally addressing ours.
So what are you doing with the Climate Act?
I think we have to find a way. I live at a company that is very much historically rooted in the Ethereum ecosystem. But I would like to believe that our equivalents of this meeting at Bitcoin CC are having this exact conversation. I don't know that they are, but I'd like to believe it.
Yeah. Well, in particular, there's an initiative that ECP is trying to compensate for the historical emissions of the entire Ethereum.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I wanted to.
You want me to talk about?
Well,
what we're doing?
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to shill on you.
Question.
I didn't think this was a me moment.
But I wanted to take that as an opportunity to go beyond and really answer this question, which is, I do think the AI space has a lot to learn from the journey that the crypto space just went through over the last few years of reckoning with the emissions associated with blockchain technology, doing what we can to mitigate them, and then telling a story about how we are going to use this technology to actually have a positive impact on what we were previously contributing a negative to. And so two areas in particular. One, I think that we can, right now it's not very clear as a user of an AI model how much emissions are actually associated with that model. Some of the cloud providers are starting to provide that information, but one way that we can very concretely use blockchain technology to address this problem is by having more transparent disclosure, ideally on a public blockchain, of the emissions associated with a given AI model. And also that the AI community can more directly confront the emissions associated with their activity and use the new carbon market infrastructure and the other environmental impact assets that are being built on blockchain to say every time you run a query on ChatGPT, compensate a small amount of carbon emissions proportional to the emissions associated with that query so that we're internalizing that externality back into the consumption of the service. But I think you also asked a question about biodiversity stuff, and I don't want to lose that thread.
I just wanted to say that I totally agree with what you just said. Yeah, I think it's totally about that. Like the, I really like the part where you said that if AI has to learn from crypto, but also can take good advantage of what's already on chain in terms of green assets in order to integrate them into their models, and shouldn't be even an option. It should be automatically compensated, and then you receive automatically the confirmation that, oh, while you were the AI was thinking for you, it also compensated that much of carbon, right?
So I have a question, I think, also sort of stemming back from the contextual moment we had at the beginning around the kick in the butt, which is that I feel as though, given that the conversation around climate change really got started in the 1960s. We're living at sort of a 60-ish, 65-ish year period of trying to make this transition happen. And we keep talking about the necessity of good data, and I think the possibility is there with blockchain, but I think also really concerned about managing the transition from the standpoint of unlocking the financial capital and really financing the transition, but also reckoning with the reality that is human greed and the way that it's sort of been structurally crystallized in capitalism. And so this is me speaking my first draft here, but I'm curious how we reckon with that, how we finance the transition, unlock more motivation and incentives, but also work towards a more decentralized, individualized, perhaps, system of shared wealth that isn't just winner take all. So that's my question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one. In many ways, the premise of market-based solutions to climate change is to harness the greed impulse and incentivize people to do the right thing rather than to just take advantage of externalities by polluting without compensating for it. But it is definitely playing with fire. It's a powerful mechanism, and if it's not structured and governed appropriately, it can be dangerous. Much more to say than that.
I mean, I also think that on the flip side of the incentive mechanisms is the question of structural organizing so as to have bargaining power. I mean, that's always has been the flip side. Now, this is how labor organizes in many ways. So I do think that here the question becomes, where are these organizing pockets? And if you look at the rights of nature discourse, for example, usually what you find is rights of nature are mediated through communities. So you would say the river has a right, but at the end of the day, it would be custodians of the river who are speaking for the river, so to speak. But I think what often is missing in that part is what is happening with the money around that. Like, how are these guardians empowered through financial flows? How are they tied into what is going on there so that they can have some more bargaining power? And again, like for SNI, for Sovereign Nation Initiative, what we are trying to do is we are trying to bring biodiversity stewards together into something like a consortium so that they can have a bit of bargaining power about giving their data to someone. Now, if that is valuable data or not for a financial product, that still remains to be seen. But this proprietary data that is really like the antennas in the mud data, how can you make it so that the communities keep a bargaining chip, I think has a lot to do with organizing as a counterbalance to the question of market-driven solutions.
I might add that the issue with the powerful interest you're looking to address with your very good question, round of applause, is the lack of accountability of the very powerful in the world. I have a slightly controversial view on this, which I've shared with my friends at CoinDesk, which is that FTX actually is proof of how accountable we are rather than proof of how greedy this industry can be, because having gone through the financial crisis of 2008, where it took 12 years before the first and only banker who ever went to jail for the financial crisis of 2008 finally went to jail through the normal TradFi lawyers court system and so forth. Now, compare this to Sam Bankman-Fried. CoinDesk runs an article. 3 months later, Sam Bankman-Fried is indicted. 8 months later, he's found guilty because blockchain provided such clear proof of what had happened to the movement of this money that there was no way he wasn't going to be found guilty and sent to prison. I don't like to see anybody sent to prison, but I do think it actually should be more internalized by us as a community as proof of how good this system is at holding people accountable. So just, I don't know if there's any good to be taken on this question of accountability as a factor versus greed as a factor. Weirdly enough, FTX is good news. 90% of the money has also been recovered because they found it.
In terms of incentivization, the day that investing in solar panel is going to be a higher return and more profitable than investing in fossil fuel, it's going to be very easy, you know?
Yeah. Just a quick one also on my opinion on that topic is I don't really believe in incentive if it's not regulation. In my perspective, without it, we cannot move. We need to force the market to finance this transition, and without the regulator, the market will not. And I think today, versus the beginning of the imagination of the theory, I think we have infrastructures that could provide proofs, transparency, whatever, could try to help to put the finger on the bad practice. So I think it's like regulation, and also a regulation being comfortable with this kind of new technology, with the side effect, of course, that it could have, but also on the positive impact of being able to do things that we were not able to do before. So I think this also could move on that topic.
And about the greed a little bit, I think that can be also played with, if I may say so. At Region Atlas, we built for Hackathon on Base this summer a project called regionatlas.fun. You can check online. It's a green coin generator. It takes inspiration from meme coins, so from greed, I imagine. But instead of using memes, you take a picture of nature that's geolocalized, and each time you do a transaction, it retires some carbon. So we played with that idea of, okay, there is a protocol that the community loves, is having fun with, speculating, and also having some greed with, to turn it, redirect it towards sustainability. So there is also something maybe to be done on that side of things.
Very quickly, other people have raised their hands. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so to add to this, well, I will share something that we are developing in Mexico is water credits from water efficiency in agriculture. So it's an association that is helping farmers to transform their irrigation system to more efficient one. So they are saving water that before they were using a lot of water to irrigate, now they are using less. And we're transforming that into water credits that companies can then buy to compensate their hydric footprint. So now it's still off-chain because that's how they've been doing the accountability part. But if we can motivate them to go on-chain to do the accounting, at least if we start with the incentive, which are the water credits that we are going to put on-chain, maybe the companies that are using those on-chain credits or those tokenized credits can later start doing their reporting on their water usage also on-chain, such as some companies are doing already their electricity consumption on-chain, and the same way as solar panels or any renewable energy project can generate the credits on-chain. So maybe we can do that for water as well. So like from... instead of from the regulator obligating the companies on the other way, from the other side, so you have tokenized credits, maybe you can tokenize also your reporting. And yeah, okay. That's an idea.
Hi. I will begin to thank you for the talk. My question is is more operational. I want to ask, what type of data do you enter in the blockchain, maybe except the carbon credit, and how do you digitize data on nature? If there is a human in the middle, how do you guarantee the quality and veracity of the data?
I can give some context from the carbon market perspective. You know, the traditional systems are, as you described, man in the middle, right? There is basically a PDF document that gets generated when a third party like sends someone out to physically look at the trees with like their eyeballs and like take notes on a clipboard. The more innovative approaches that we've seen emerging recently, there's a group we're working with called Kurest that is using a Chainlink Oracle to take satellite data from a public satellite data provider. They put that satellite data on chain and they perform a computation, an on-chain computation, to calculate the biomass present in that satellite image. And then that is the basis for which the carbon credit is issued on chain. So this is the DMRV approach that was mentioned earlier. So there's a lot of exciting innovation in that space, but there is a legitimate hard problem, depending on the methodology. Is there sufficient data available in a digital stream that you can actually calculate the thing you need to calculate to derive the carbon credit value? And for something like total biomass from a satellite, it's relatively straightforward to calculate. But if you're talking about something like a solar panel installation, you need to have a physical device on the solar panel installation to measure the flux of energy coming out of that thing. And so then you need to talk about things like having a signing key on that physical device so that if it was tampered with, you'd be able to tell that the data was being manipulated. I hope that was helpful.
A quick one. It was a really complete answer. Maybe another approach that could help also to answer to this question. So actually, what you put in the blockchain is the data that you have and that you measure. So it's, as maybe said it again, it's, again, only a system. The carbon credit don't exist, really. It's a synthetic. It's already something that could be said. It's already digitalized. It's just a way to store the data. And what is interesting about the interoperability of the blockchain is that you have the shared backend. Let's say it's a backend. It's shared by all the actors of the market. So you have people that certificate the assets, they certificate the data, let's say, at the beginning. The others operate on it to say, hey, I consume, I sell, I market make, and so on. And you have the people that say, so you can guarantee that if all the people interoperate on the same backend, they don't duplicate the information, and you reduce the friction, the number of friction for the mistake, for the trust issue that you can have. But at the same thing, if you put shit in the blockchain, you guarantee the integrity of shitty data, let's say. So you have to monitor it, as you said, how you guarantee that the data is correct and the carbon credit is not obsolete, how do you guarantee that the project is still occurring and so on. So you have the monitoring, as I said, that we call DMRV. It's appellation for this kind of guys that provide automated verification data. You could use satellite imagery. But the things of having an interoperable system is that you could have these guys operating on the data that is available for everyone, but you could also have two things that could improve the level of security on the monitoring is that the concurrence, so the competition, having a lot of competitor that monitor the same data, we could detect like non-consistency and identify more specifically an issue if there is. And the other one is on the probability, but maybe we don't need to go that further about how do you prove that the guys that provide the data did run the computation, did run the algorithm. So you could also use the blockchain to store the proof that the algorithm to run the AI and the satellite imagery, for example, have been computed. I will stop here for now.
And actually in that debate, that's actually the reason why we need more assets to be natively issued on-chain in terms of green crypto assets. Because if you take the data that has been produced by off-chain registries, you can't trust them the way you will trust data that has been gathered and tokenized immediately by the asset producers themselves. That's why on the Region Atlas we try to put how on-chain the asset actually is, and to put all the green crypto assets not in competition to each other, but yeah, let's say like they want to do better, and we value that specifically, that the assets are on-chain native and not brought from off-chain registries.
Hello, my name is Noemi. I'm a former PhD candidate in digital currencies. I would like to ask maybe a little survey. Who knows about the CSRD, European Commission report? Okay, so most of the speakers. So just to say, this is a rules applies to big corporate in order to publish regular reports on the social and environmental risks they face. And I was wondering if it's representing for you an opportunity to bridge the gap between corporates, whole traditional finance, and blockchain, because I guess we do need some verifiable reports and ledgers. So what the opportunity for you from a CSRD regulation and blockchain projects?
It's part of the translation work. I mean, I think there's a lot of translation work and how you can, collect this data in a way that is going to be valued by corporation that might invest into your project, then it's good if it corresponds to the CSRD framework or other frameworks, depending on what they are really looking at. So yes, it's part of that.
Very quickly, putting my timekeeper hat, let's try to keep answers as concise as possible, because there are plenty of people in the room that wants to speak as well, and time is running out, so go ahead.
Very briefly, I think that the CSR directive is really well done, I have to say, in a sense, to the regulator, because what it makes very attractive is what could be called something like insetting. So the focus has to be on the own supply chain. So offsetting, buying credits, buying whatever things, is not going to do anything to these corporates. And also the way that they have to report is that they have to report all of their chain and all of their activities. So if you have like a cheap whatever project where you have some offsetting, it will look really crappy in the report. So I think they did really well in that. And I think that they push everyone else with this regulation into saying, what does it mean to actually work on your own supply chain in order to green that? So I think that for people who are doing projects on credits, it's not great news, because specifically the carbon offsetting is not a proposition that is in the directive, but I think that's a good push.
I'll just speak briefly on the U.S. situation. So the SEC has just put in place regulations that are quite similar. I'm not super familiar with CSRD. I'm more familiar with the U.S. regulations. But they're going to require all publicly traded companies to disclose their emissions, as well as any use of carbon credits. So I think that creates a really powerful focus point for pressure on these corporations who aren't using carbon credits to start compensating for their emissions, and those who are to be using the highest integrity emissions carbon credits possible, and also reducing their emissions over time so that their claim of being carbon neutral is credible.
And blockchains themselves are included, not specifically in that piece of legislation, but the under the legislation which governs blockchain generally, blockchains by December 30th of this year have to deliver to the EC a report on their own carbon footprint. For stablecoins, the deadline was June 30. So you're going to start to see more from our own community in terms of revelation on this.
Hi, my name's Lauren Sirota. I know a lot of you in this room. I've co-founded and advised a couple climate tech companies. I work with Good Dollar and the Climate Collective. And the first thing I want to acknowledge is that we're having 20 conversations, which is fantastic and spectacular. From the importance of equitable inclusion of local populations in business models to DMRV to intergovernmental climate accountability. And so the thing, you sparked something that I wanted to just bring up and ask everybody to share, which is with all of these conversations, it's impossible when we're creating all these new things to be expert in all of them at once. And as evidenced by decisions that were made by platforms like Ethereum to not necessarily only motivated by climate, but to move to a proof of work model in order to kind of reduce their carbon footprint. Everybody in this room who is building something has an accountability to make those same decisions based on their domain knowledge to make the ethical and responsible decision, and those things stick. So just like the example of FTX being a great example of accountability based on negative behaviors, those same things happen when there's positive accountability. So I would love to hear, each of you is kind of in a position of power within your organization, if you felt those tensions in any of the decisions that you've had to make or pushed for that really do make a huge difference but might seem small, because I think those are often underappreciated and they're the significant things that make a difference.
I can maybe start. It's not climate related, but crypto related in a sense. So the Region Atlas, the project I've co-founded, we are working to decentralize the front end. That was a technical choice that was in tension with certain values, which are not environmental, but like how do we make the whole application as decentralized as possible, and also the whole source code open source. So that's something that is more annoying to do. It's more work. Yet we believe it's important also in terms of value, because we believe decentralization is the key.
Yeah, in the climate world, one of the big tensions that we faced is, you know, should we have started with the existing credits that were out there in circulation, primarily issued by Vera, or should we have started only with the on-chain native credits that were being issued?
I think you have an answer to that based on past behavior, right?
Well, and the hard part is, in some ways, the fact that we made such a splash in the carbon market had to do with the fact that we supported the largest registry in the market. If we had only supported the on-chain credits, it would have been a much smaller market, total market size. And so there is this tension about trying to work within an incumbent system versus sort of burning the whole thing down and building it anew. I'm a pretty pragmatic person. I think we kind of have to do both at the same time. But the question is, how do you work with those incumbent players in a way that is not compromising the values of transparency, decentralization that the space is coming from?
And how do you persist in the face of an entire industry revolting against you because of the misunderstanding of the decisions? So I think that's a good example of how we can all just make sure that we understand the context in which the decisions were made and who made them and why before we're critical, because I think it's very easy. I've seen you yourself be canceled multiple times and then have to do the work of educating other people as to why decisions were made. And so it's really, these are complex issues, right? And the decisions that people who run businesses are making are like very complex decisions. So we should respect each other and know that there's good intention.
I'm going to go back to what you said earlier, which clearly resonates in the room. The way the Ethereum climate platform was created was to say that the Ethereum, which it turns out, may be the most extensive and expensive carbon mitigation, successful carbon mitigation ever accomplished in business or industry, in the sense that here was an industry that had $300-400 billion tied up in it that risked the security of the entire platform in order, the entire protocol, in order to reform itself, and in doing so drop 99.92% of its carbon footprint. But the way we went about forming the Ethereum Climate Platform was to interview the devs that actually did the work. And we said, well, no, hold on. We didn't do this. Y'all did this. 120 devs around the world. So we started talking to those devs to said, well, you know, what would you consider the outcome to make you proud of what you did that that was worth addressing? And what came back to us was, well, we're leaving behind 7 years of proof of work. Let's not pretend that didn't happen. Let's look at those 7 years. Let's measure what that carbon debt is to the planet, broadly speaking, and let's try to pay it back over the next few years. But it started, I think, in a kind of rather nice, accountable way by saying to the devs that actually did the work, what would you like to see happen?
We've got at least two more contributions from the room, and I really want you two to have the time to speak your mind. So please go ahead, one after the other, and then we'll have probably a last round of sharing before this conference comes to a close.
Two future decisions. So we heard about blockchain helping with data and also with the finances. We apparently need data in order to kind of like believe what's going on out there. Like the planetary system is not working. Indigenous people don't really need it. They are the sensors of data themselves, can already interpret the data because they have the inherent knowledge and they can act upon it. That is something we don't have. So I'm wondering, looking at future decisions, what would you need to have a more seamless interface between on-chain, whatever you're doing there, finances, data, yada, yada, and putting it off-chain? You mentioned an off-chain project that wants to come on-chain, so you can probably get more data, more legitimization for finances coming in. But there's the other side. So I'm wondering, what would you need, both from the community, tech-wise perhaps, and within yourself? What are you up to close the gap?
I'm going to be really quick and really technical on that part. So trying to put the computation off-chain and only keep the proofs on-chain. So what do we need to have to guarantee the integrity, the trust, the transparency? I don't know if it was exactly the question. But
I mean the translation. You've got the you've got all the knowledge on-chain, but it needs to be translated on the ground, because otherwise, like, all the data is great, but otherwise, like, planet doesn't care about, but technically.
Missed the question.
Yeah. Okay.
I let the.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I fully understand the question either, but I would say that a big issue in crypto that has not been resolved is the user experience issue. So if you're talking about like a tribe of people in the Amazon living in the rainforest who are going to be paid to protect the forest in which they live rather than cutting it down and selling the logs for money to live, they need to be onboarded onto the internet. They need to be given access to.
But why would they need that? They need to put whatever, like what they need is not data. They don't need digital stuff. They need to act upon the ground.
Right.
No,
so
blockchain can change the soil.
Well, maybe I'm making an assumption, which is that the communities, in order to carry out these activities, they need money. They need finances to do this stuff, right? Someone to pay for the water filtration system. And so the question is, how do they receive that money? And so they'll go in and need things like internet access, a nice user experience where it's easy, just as if they were to receive cash, you know, in hand, or to receive a good in hand, that they can receive that flow of funds. And there's a user experience problem there to solve that we as a crypto community have not really addressed, which is like, if I wanted to set up my mom to receive, say, like I'm gonna pay her rent, let's say, and I wanna set her up to receive that in the form of crypto, that's a pretty daunting challenge right now. But there are some really exciting developments going on in the technical side to make it easier to onboard people to receive those payments directly, rather than being channeled through, say, an NGO.
I mean, very quickly, because I think this is really the bread and butter of our business, is the question of how do biodiversity stewards get funds from the projects that we do? How do they receive that? One question is the user interface, is the question of how can they account for crypto in their finances? They are not-for-profit organizations. They have a problem having crypto on their balance sheet. So there are a lot of problems from the legal side. But I do think what for us is one, and I think your question was excellent, where are the painful moments of decision-making? One of the things that we ask ourselves all along is, we are creating a lot of money, we are spending a lot of money, we are paying ourselves salaries, we are doing all these things. How are we making sure that actually what we are doing will have an impact that is sufficiently big on the ground to justify this whole schmo? And so I think this is something where for us, I mean, we try with a very banal 50% minimum of the revenue goes to the stewards. But that is just a weird mechanism. So I think the other part where it comes in is exactly the question of how can you make it so that people who have been doing this for many, many years can continue living the life they live and expand on that by bringing them sufficient financial means and through that make sure that they can communicate what they are doing to green finance. So how can communities on the ground make sure that whatever they do is understood as good nature behavior and can go into a database? And I think that's super difficult. And there the question of what is a qualitative metric? Can you work with that? Can you work with film? Can you work with art? Can you work with, I know I'm sounding crazy, yeah, but you have to have like some quantitative metrics for sure that has the base layer, but how can you go beyond that so that it becomes more seamless for people to express what they are doing? I think that's one of the biggest challenges.
And to Marcus's point, though, what we're trying to move is resources from one place to the other, and to move it into these communities, what we concluded early on is we absolutely needed a solution because we were planning to do a lot of work with stakeholders in the Global South, and they all do, and some of them that don't even have internet have cell phones. And if you look at Celo, C-E-L-O, if you don't know it, you should know it, because Celo has the ability to create payment rails built into mobile phones, and they are a terrific solution that our community has.
On the next discussion. Yeah, we'll hear from them during the next discussion. Jeanne, did you want to bounce on this? No, not really. Then, sir, please go ahead with your contribution.
I know some projects that are really doing that in Brazil, and with people, regenerative farmers that just share the proof of regeneration, and then the organization is making sure to value this data. And so it works.
Hi, I'm Morgan, a heavily opinionated nobody. I really want to push harder on what my colleague said earlier. I think I'm quite... You know, I'm glad we're all sat here having these discussions, but I hear a lot of talk about finance, assets, development of technology, use of data. And I am a little bit frustrated because I can't help but feel that, you know, we're distracted and we're focusing on the wrong things. And I wanted to ask the question, or at least put the thought out there, that, like, you know, the world exists the way it does today because we set up certain systems and we have a cultural practice that led us to where we are. And I struggle to see how focusing on these things, especially institutional buy-in, is going to change anything, because the way in which technologies are developed, the way in which finance works, and the people with the power and the money have got there because of certain values. And those values are, you know, extractivist, exploitative, capitalizing, and, you know, fundamentally individualist. Yeah, I feel like there's a lack of a more political grounding in some of these conversations and just this space in general, in thinking that, you know, if we play the game by the same rules, that there can be a different outcome. And I think, you know, my hope for blockchain and why I got into the space was because it represents, you know, it holds a lot of the values that I think are positive and more fundamentally human, but I don't buy the argument that humans are greedy. I think we're greedy because of the system that surrounds us and has forced us to be so.
I don't think an extractive economy is a matter of value. I think it's related to the fact that until very recently, we were small humans within a very big nature ecosystem. So we were thinking that natural resources were infinite. And this is a psychological resource. This is a psychological way of looking to and belonging to something infinite. And today we are aware that the extraction, you know, has put some limit into, we don't have this infinite relationship anymore within our ecosystem. So it's not a matter of value, it's just a matter of interaction. And what is true is that we have lost the system, again, not a value, of producing regenerative. But because we misunderstood the fact that actually we are on a linear and not a regenerative circle. So we have cut the organic and biological way of thinking. But because we became too big, you understand what I mean? I want to, because I've been in that, you know, I was like you when I was your age. And the question, no, but I want to say it's important. It's really important. I'm still working in this field since this time. Okay, so it's important to understand that it's not only a matter of being on the good or bad side. It's a matter of a system thinking that has to be disrupted or that is changing. And it's not accusing people of just being greedy. I mean, we are human, and we are using energy, and we want to control more energy. But so the question to me, and I will connect this with a question I wanted to raise here, is that what I see in this field of regenerative finance is that do we need a common language or not to be more efficient? And do you think that we already have this common language?
Louise wanted to say something, we're really reaching the end of the panel. Someone has something, yep. like Louise first, you chip in, and very last remarks so we can move into
it. It's going to be real quick. It's just like, I want to talk to you after because I want you to explain to me what do you think blockchain is not disruptive and why do you think blockchain is actually following the same capitalist path, because I think on the whole contrary, it's super disruptive and it goes against. I can talk to him afterwards.
All right.
And a very quick remark, it's not a question. On the idea that we need to bring internet connection, for example, in local communities, indigenous communities, I think that's a stretch. And in the meantime, perhaps we can use systems, traditional systems, like delegating someone in the community to have access to the internet somewhere, and then they can bring the funds into the community to create the impact that we desire. So,
and if you want
to say that, thank you very much.
If you want to hear more about this, tune into the podcast where Ethic Hub actually mentioned how they reach farmers that are non-bankerized and do not have an access to internet. Very quick closing remarks to the ones of you that have perhaps spoken a little bit less.
Yeah, just wanted to say, to jump on what you said before, I think it's, I'm working mainly on the financial side of things, and we all say we want to redirect capital towards things that matters. The thing is, where is the capital and how do we manage to get that capital? And I do feel if we manage to shift between people who can invest as long as they don't have the governance. I'm looking for funds, for big funds, but I don't want them to have the governance on the product and on the companies that are getting funded. And I think that's where we need to find the right way to do that, because if they give us the money, but they don't have the governance, we might be able at least to go faster. And I think we need to manage to go faster.
Yeah, I want to throw out a metaphor that was really helpful for me in understanding this situation. Jean mentioned systems change, and you know, thinking about how do systems change, how do you as an individual agent within a very complex and large system have the most leverage? One metaphor that might be helpful is the distinction between an insider, an outsider, and a beyonder. And these are sort of three different roles you can take when you're interacting with a large complex system. You can be inside the institutions trying to make incremental change, advocating for reform within the existing system. You can be outside in the street with a sign, you know, protesting, saying these are my values, this is what I think the system should be. Or you can be a beyonder. You can go out on your own, build some new thing, some experiment on a local scale, and see, like, does this new way of running a system work? And if it does, maybe the insiders can take some of those ideas from the beyonders, advocate for systems change, and push that through under pressure from the outsiders, putting pressure on the people in the institution to change that system. I think we need all three. It's hard to It's hard for any one of those groups of people to implement system change on their own, but by working together and in a space like this in crypto, I find a lot of insiders, beyonders, and outsiders talking to each other, which I think can be really productive.
It's gonna be hard to top that off, so do you really want to take a crack at it?
Well, in a way, I think he did. I mean, this young man has created this extremely important, unfortunately, at the end of the session conversation, and I would just simply urge all of us to remember that even though we're here as speakers, we are part of the disruption. We are not, in some way, the elite of that. We have a responsibility, and I think as long as we remember that we are stewards of that trust and not the owners of that trust, I think we have a chance to live up to the promise of this, and maybe next year, come closer to that reality.
And on these beautiful words, I invite all of you to put your hands together for all of the guests. We have a quick recess. How much time before moving to the next panel?
And just a quick word of thanks for our moderator as well, and thank you for hosting the stage.
So see you all back in this room in 20 minutes for the last conference dedicated to peer-to-peer money and its impact. Thank you very much.